The porter was nowhere to be seen when I left. The journalist and the photographer had disappeared. The chauffeur was dozing at the wheel of the Mercedes, its peaked cap pulled over his eyes. The dogs in the park had all gone home and the day was dark far too soon. I was walking to the car, kicking through the piles of autumn leaves and thinking of Natasha Buck's long, naked limbs, when DCI Mallory called. "It wasn't beginner's luck," he said. "We've got another one." Chapter 4. A blacked-out mortuary van waited at the mouth of the alley as the swirling blue lights of a dozen response cars lit up the Soho night. Uniformed officers were still unreeling spools of blue and white crime scene tape across Shaftesbury Avenue and shoving back crowds hopeful of glimpsing fresh corpse. I ducked under the tape. The airwave digital radios chattered and clacked. The soccos were putting on their head-to-toe white bodysuits, while Mallory's two detective inspectors, Gain and Whitestone, were already ripping off their protective gear. They were excited. "It's a good body," Gain said to me. He was young and black. His head shaved fashionably clean, and under his protective clothes he was far better dressed than he needed to be. I pulled on thin blue latex gloves. "A good body." "A bad body is one that's found by the public," Whitestone said. "Some drunk who needs a pee or a puke, a dog walker clomping through the gore before it's had a chance to get cold, destroying evidence, tampering with the scene before we've even confirmed death." Whitestone was in her middle 30s, a thoughtful-looking blonde woman with black-rimmed glasses. You might not have guessed she had more than 10 years on murder investigation teams. "A good body is one that's found by the police when it's definitely dead. A good body keeps things simple, saves us work." "And this is a good body," Gaines said, and then, "We read about you. You're famous, Wolf. What did they call you in court?"
"Officer A," I said.
"Officer A. You were in SO15. I nodded.
"Surveillance officer, counter-terrorism command."
"You were a surveillance officer," he said, clearly underwhelmed.
I could see how a homicide detective like Gain would think surveillance was life in the slow lane. "It's true. There was a lot of hanging around, following people on foot and in cars and watching endless hours of CCTV footage, whereas homicide and serious crimes work is carried out by murder investigation teams, the Metropolitan Police's specialised murder squads, and is one of the Met's elite units, investigating nothing but murder, manslaughter, and the threat of murder." But Gain made it sound like I'd spent my time asking people if they wanted fries with that shake.
"I heard that it would never have detonated," he said with a grin, "because the bomber ruined the cook."
"I heard that too," I said, flexing my fingers inside the latex gloves. "In court, the tech guy said the perp didn't distill the hydrogen peroxide to the correct concentration. Simmered when he should have stirred. Forgot to whisk his egg white. Maybe it's true.
Maybe they're just trying to cheer us up.
Anyone who makes a bomb in their old mum's kitchen can't be that bright, can they?"
"And what did they give you?" Gain asked.
"The Queen's Police Medal." He almost whistled.
"A QPM. Was it for exceptional courage, skill, exhibiting conspicuous devotion to duty, or all three?" He laughed.
"Lucky he had a bomb in his bag, or they would have given you 20 years to life."
"It's good to have you, Wolf," Whitestone told me, ending the chat. "The boss is waiting for you."
Soccos were putting up arc lights at the end of the alley, where Mallory stood next to a black shape lying on the ground by giant recycling bins, his long, lean figure stock still in the blazing white glare as the scene was carefully prepared, looking like an actor waiting for his cue to step on stage. The filthy alley felt like it was light years away from the shining tower where we had found Hugo Buck.
"I thought we had another one," I said.
"We do," Mallory said. "There's a look that you see in all boxers and in certain breeds of dog. German shepherds have it. It is a look that reveals knowledge of how serious the world is." Mallory had that look now.
"Different postcode, same killer," he said. "Look."
The dead man wore the sad rags of homelessness, and someone had cut his throat out. All of it. The fierce white lights revealed a neck that had been ripped open, torn out. The front half of the victim's neck cleaved clean away. Again. It felt like only the spine was keeping the head attached to the body. Again. Mallory was right. The homeless man in the stinking alley was a world away from the banker in his glass tower, but he was another one. Even under the arc lights, the alley was cold, and through the thin rubber gloves, I could feel the sweat tingle on my palms. I turned on my torch to look beyond the reach of the light's glare and let the thin beam trace slowly across the great spurts of arterial blood covering the walls and the recycling bins. I turned the torch off as I looked at the blood that soaked and stained the top half of the body. The blood stank with that distinctive metallic odour that is also sickeningly human, and the smell mixed with the fuel and food and alcohol scents of the West End. I tried to look beyond the blood and the horror. I tried to look at what had once been a man. His hair was long and matted, the clothes rags, blackened by the grinding toll of living on the streets. It was hard to estimate his age because he looked all used up, as though he had lived an entire lifetime long before this brutal death. "There will be needle marks on his arms," I said, "and perhaps on the legs and even between the toes." Mallory said, "But why kill a man who was so busy killing himself?" There were a few pitiful belongings by the dead man's side. A black rubbish bag secured by an elastic band holding his worldly goods. A woolen cap, still full of coins, and a musical instrument. A thin piece of black wood with a complicated tangle of silver metal buttons and keys. "Clarinet," I said. "Not a clarinet," Mallory said. "Too small. An oboe." "Nobody's busking is that bad," said one of the socos. Nobody laughed. Mallory's gaze took in the bloodied body, the untouched money and the musical instrument. He shook his head with what looked like real sadness. "Looks like he was on the streets for a while," I said. "Plenty of addicts and former addicts around Soho. But the homeless don't often kill each other." "No," Mallory agreed. "It's the people with homes to go to who are the problem." I looked back at the street. The socos moved in slow motion now, plodding white ghosts, falling into their routine of photographing footprints, gathering cigarette butts, collecting fibres, prints and samples of blood. One of them was drawing a sketch. The photographer stopped taking stills and started filming the scene. The usual crop of small-numbered yellow markers were blooming on the ragged ground, and the socos trod carefully between them, like scientists tiptoeing through the aftermath of nuclear Armageddon. Beyond them, in the festival swirl of the blue lights of our cars, uniformed officers were pushing back the crowds, recording the drama on their phones. "They think we're putting on Les Miserables down here," Mallory sighed. "This is a strange space, isn't it?" I lifted my head. Mallory was right. It was not really an alley at all, more of a crevice between two of the grand old theatres of Shaftesbury Avenue. At the end of the alley, above the heads of the gawping crowd, I could see the bright lights of the very heart of the city. The white neon of the theatre marquees, the reds and golds of Chinatown. "And nobody heard a thing," Mallory said, reading my mind. "Because his track ear had been cut," I said. "No windpipe, no scream." As the crowds were moved to the far side of the street, their voices rose in protest. They craned their necks for a better view and held their little phones even higher above their heads. "God spared us from stupid people with smartphones," Mallory muttered. The socos began to erect a tent over the dead man to shield the scene from the public and to protect the 1,000 tiny scraps of evidence from the weather. Mallory's gaze settled on the beanie cap full of coins, then moved on to the musical instrument.
What kind of heroin addict busks with an oboe? He said.
I thought about it. One who comes from money. One who had all the chances. One who comes from privilege. The music teacher coming round once a week to practice the oboe. The lessons going on for years. Money, never a problem.
Mallory ran the palm of one large hand over his bald head and then pushed his John Lennon glasses a bit further up his broken nose.
Or maybe he just stole it.
A beat. But I don't think so. I think you're right. I think there was all kind of care lavished on him. A long time ago now.
The flash from Asoko's camera lit up a part of the alley wall that the arc lights had not reached. Among the fresh spurts of travel blood, there was a tangle of graffiti I had missed. One word shouted at me and I stepped closer to see, although I already knew what it said. Pig. On the far side of the street, I could see perhaps 100 mobile phones, held above the shoulders of the uniformed officers who stood on the far side of the police do not cross tape. The crowds had been pushed right back now, but the numbers were growing, stretching our officers, and as their excitement mounted, the white lights on their phones glowed like the eyes of wolves in winter.
Asoko came down the alley, carrying a laptop in one hand and pulling off her face mask with the other.
Good body, sir, she said to Mallory.
No witness, no weapon, no CCTV, no ID, and no glove prints, he said. I've seen better.
In the morning, I took care of my daughter and my dog, and then I drove to work. 27 Savile Row, London West 1. The Met call it West End Central. 27 Savile Row is a modern block of offices with one of those ancient blue police lamps outside. The kind of blue lamp that makes you think of Sherlock Holmes hunting Jack the Ripper through the London fog. But although Savile Row is famous for two things, West End Central isn't one of them. For hundreds of years, Savile Row has been home to the most exclusive men's tailors in the world. The short Mayfair Street is also where, on the rooftop high above number 3, the Beatles played their final gig, attracting the attention of the local police. The attending officers from West End Central let the Beatles finish their last ever set because they were all music fans. That's what they tell you in West End Central. Carrying the triple espresso I had bought in Bar Italia in Soho, I went up to the major incident room, MIR1, on the top floor. MIR1 would be the centre of homicide's murder investigation. It was a large suite of connecting rooms with a computer station at every desk, and it was now completely empty, apart from DCI Mallory, who stood cradling a carton of takeaway tea as he stared at a blank whiteboard.
You're early, he said. Morning briefing's not for an hour.
I thought I'd be the first to arrive, sir, I said. Look keen and all that. He laughed.
I like to spend a bit of time figuring before I start opening my mouth. He said. What could possibly connect a wealthy investment banker and a homeless heroin addict?
He shook his head.
I don't know. I have no idea. And I need to know. At least, I need to have a theory.
He sipped his tea.
Have you heard of the Golden Hour Principle?
I nodded. It means early action can secure material that would otherwise be lost. Witnesses remember things more clearly, offenders can still be nearby. CCTV footage hasn't been deleted. The longer we leave it, the harder it all gets.
I believe in the Golden Hour Principle as much as the next man, Mallory said, but I also believe in what the old SIOs call creating slow time, meaning you need to put your foot on the ball and have a figure, meaning you have to leave time for figuring as well as action.
He was such a soft-spoken man that it took me a moment to realise that by coming in early I had intruded upon his private time, his figuring time. He must have seen the alarm on my face.
Why don't you go down to the basement, he suggested kindly. See if you can find out weapon.
He held out an A4 file. Take this with you.
Sir.
I bolted my coffee,
and went down to the basement. The lift doors opened onto a low-ceilinged room where row upon row of canteen dining tables were covered with knives. A young, uniformed officer was filming them and making notes on a clipboard. He looked like a tourist in some exotic marketplace.
"Help you, sir,"
he said. "I'm looking for a knife," I said.
"What kind of knife, sir?"
"A knife that can do this." There were four photographs inside the file, two of Hugo Buck's corpse and the other two of the homeless man. They were all graphic close-ups of the fatal wounds. I held them up for the constable and saw the blood drain from his face.
"Go ahead, sir," he said. "We've got all sorts here."
It was true. There were hundreds, perhaps thousands, of knives glinting under the harsh strip lighting. Knives that had been seized, found, dumped, bagged as evidence, or surrendered during an amnesty. So many knives that I didn't see how I could fail to find a suitable candidate for the one that had cut the throats of the banker and the unknown man. The uniformed officer had fallen into step beside me. He cleared his throat nervously.
"It's PC Green, sir," he said.
"PC Billy Green? From that morning at the bank, you told me to breathe when I came over all funny." I looked at him properly and remembered the young officer who was good for nothing after finding the body. "PC Green," I said. "You don't call me sir just because I'm in plain clothes." I was wearing my black Paul Smith wedding suit, Savile Row being still a bit beyond my pay grade. "I'm a detective constable, DC Wolf, exactly the same rank as you. You can call me Wolf, you can call me Max, you can call me pretty much whatever you like. But if you call me sir, then you make both of us look stupid. You do know that a DC has exactly the same powers and authority as a uniformed PC, don't you?" He looked embarrassed.
"Of course, sir, Max, DC Wolf, but anyway, I didn't thank you."
"A lot of them were laughing at me for wimping out that day. You helped. It definitely helps. The breathing." "You're not on the street anymore." His white face flushed red. "They've put me on desk duties, reassigned. A canteen cowboy." He laughed miserably. "They think I fell to bits." I grimaced. "That's a bit odd." Green gestured at the knives, changing the subject.
"See what you're looking for?"
"Not yet." I walked between the tables, looking at the knives in their careful lines, throwing knives, hunting knives, Bowie knives, knives so small and thin they could fit into a credit card holder, samurai swords, carpet cutters, Gurkha cookeries, rust-dappled Stanley knives, and the height of knife fashion, compact, semi-automatic folding knives with titanium handles and stainless steel blades, knives that whipped out like a gunslinger drawing his Colt 45. I picked one up and looked at it in my hand.
"We're getting a lot of those," Green said. "Gang members like them. You think it might be something like that?"
"I don't see how it can be," I said, replacing the knife. "It's not long enough. I figure what I'm looking for is about 12 inches long, most of it blade. It has to be a blade that's long and thin and I guess double-edged. Something that's made to cut throats." He swallowed hard.
"This is about Bob the Butcher, isn't it?"
"Who is Bob the Butcher?"
He fetched his laptop and found the page, a newspaper's website.
"Bob the Butcher Stalks Scared City Boys" by Scarlett Bush, crime correspondent. Champagne-swilling city boys are living in mortal terror after a senior detective revealed that the death of investment banker Hugo Buck was a hate crime. "Yes, Bob the Butcher murdering that innocent young banker was a hate crime," confirmed Detective Constable Max Wolfe. "But then all murder is a hate crime. In the bars, all over the financial district, high-flying young city boys, busy blowing their bonuses, are now living in abject terror of Bob the Butcher." "It's terrible to think that Bob the Butcher is targeting bankers," said Bruno Mancini, in fashionable Cheapside watering hole, The Lucky Cripple. "What's wrong with being rich? We work hard for our success."
I cursed under my breath. I didn't say any of that, I said, then glanced at the piece again. Well, maybe just a bit of it. There was a small photograph next to the article. It was a young woman outside the flat in Regent's Park. I wasn't sure what this meant, but I knew it wasn't good. The one good thing was that she had not connected the murder of Hugo Buck with the unknown man in the alley, but it was the only good thing. I carried on walking between the tables, somehow knowing that the knife I was looking for would not be found here. Thanks for your help, Billy. I'm sorry they took you off the street. He brightened. It's actually not so bad. I like the nights, and you get a sense of the history down here. Have you got a minute? Have a look at this. Green opened the door to a storage room. It was as small and cluttered as an attic that had been abandoned around the time the Beatles were playing on a rooftop at the other end of Savile Row. It's full of stuff that nobody knows what to do with, Green said. It's not evidence, so they can't bag it. It's not junk, so they can't chuck it out. And it's not important enough to be in a museum. I think they've all just forgotten about it. Have a look, DC Wolf. We stepped into the dusty room, and I looked around in disbelief. There was a stovepipe hat, half eaten away by moths and mould. Cardboard boxes overflowing with old-fashioned rubber truncheons. A collapsed stack of elderly riot shields. Metropolitan Police baseball caps that had never quite caught on. A rack of heavyweight Kevlar jackets. Nothing like the wafer-thin stab-proof numbers that we had these days. And there were other bits and pieces of uniform. Helmets with the badge gone. Jackets with their brass buttons missing. Abandoned kit that had to be 25, 100 years old. Police junk that nobody quite had the heart or the energy or the permission to chuck away. So they just stuck it in here. Have you heard of the Black Museum? Green said. It's in New Scotland Yard. It's closed to the public. This is just like the Black Museum. I smiled. This is a bit more of a mess than the Black Museum. It's true that the Black Museum has a lot of old kit. Guns, knives, walking sticks that turn into swords, umbrellas that turn into guns. They've got a sword that turns into a knife called a cop killer. But the Black Museum is not really a museum at all. It's more of a classroom, a training aid. Green's eyes were wide. You've seen it? I nodded. Part of my training. They've got a display about Met officers killed in the line of duty. They show you around the Black Museum so that it doesn't happen to you. Green took a deep breath and let it out slowly as he turned to point at a dusty shelf in the darkest corner of that strange little room. Look, he said. I can't see anything, I said, taking a step closer to where he was indicating. And then I saw it. It was an ancient leather bag sitting all by itself on a shelf tangled with cobwebs. The dark brown cowhide was worn and cracked. The brass hardware and locks were blackened with rust. Green lifted it up for my inspection, and at the back of the shelf a spider scuttled away as if late for an urgent appointment. It looks like an old doctor's bag, I said. It's a Gladstone bag, Green said. What makes this one special is that it's a murder bag. I think it's one of the originals. Did you ever hear of murder bags? I shook my head. Murder bags were where modern detective work began, he explained. They had two of them in the yard from 1925, always packed and ready to go. They contained rubber gloves, magnifying glasses, containers for holding blood, test tubes for fingerprinting, all sorts of gear. The murder bags came in when Sir Bernard Spilsbury saw a detective handling a dismembered body with his bare hands. They were the start of modern homicide investigation. He looked at me shyly. What you do? He gently replaced the ruined old bag as if it was priceless. The history, he said. I love all the history. One thing I don't understand, I said. Green looked at me. Your colleague, the woman PC, told me that the dead banker was your first dead body. PC Wren, he said. Edie, yes. But that can't be true, I said. How long have you been in uniform, Green? 6 years? You must have seen more dead bodies than me, I said. You must have averaged a dead person every day. Motorists who went through their windscreens while sending a text,
cyclist who got hit by a bus, pedestrians who got hit by the cyclists and the motorists. I shook my head. I can't believe that Hugo Butt was your first dead body.
Green thought about it.
It's true, he said. I've seen a lot of dead people, but what Edie, what PC Wren and I found that morning on the floor of that man's office, it wasn't rotten luck or fate or stupidity. It didn't happen because somebody was drunk or stoned or sending a text message. What happened to that man, that banker, was the most deliberate thing in the world. It felt like a violation of everything. It's not like the daily slaughter on the roads. I don't know how to explain it. It's just different, isn't it?
I nodded.
You're right. Murder's different.
I wake too soon. It is the sharp point of the night. Too late to go back to sleep, too early to get up. I slip out of bed and go to the window. The lights are blazing in the meat market. I come back and sit on the bed, and I still haven't looked at the alarm clock. It feels like catching the eye of a madman, and then I look. 3:50. I walk across to the big cupboard built into the wall and push the double doors. They spring open, and the collection of belts and necklaces hanging on the back of the door jangle softly in the dark. There are shoes on the left-hand side, all kinds of women's shoes, strappy sandals and spike heels. On the right are stacks of drawers, knitwear, carefully folded jeans that will never be worn again. And directly in front of me, there are all the hangers with her dresses and skirts and shirts and jackets and tops. Lots of white cotton, but splashes of colour too, although you can't see it in this light. But there are orange silks and blue batik and gauzy things spangled with silver, soft as a feather, light as a sigh. I spread my arms wide and sort of gently fall against it, pressing my face into her clothes, her essence, the old life. I breathe her in, and then I sleep.
Chapter 5.
The children had painted their families. An entire wall in the classroom was covered with pictures of brightly coloured stick figures. At 5, they were starting to make sense of the world and their place in it. The stick figure mothers had long flowing hair, squiggly lines of black, brown and yellow, and some of them held a sausage-shaped package with a circle for its head, a baby brother or sister. The fathers were mostly bigger stick insect figures, and nearly all of them carried brown squares and rectangles, briefcases. All of the pictures seemed to be full of life, crowded with parents, siblings, stick figures of assorted shapes and sizes, apart from scouts.
"Look, that's my one," she said.
How could I miss it? In Scout's picture, there was just an unsmiling stick figure daddy with no briefcase, a little stick figure girl with huge brown eyes, and at our feet, a small red, four-legged daub, Stan. We had left the dog at home that morning, to his high-pitched howls of rage and despair, because once a month the parents were allowed into the classroom to look at the children's work. It was meant to be a happy time, but I looked at her picture as parents and children jostled around us, and I didn't know what to say. Most of the dads were dressed in suits and ties and carrying briefcases, while the mothers were either dressed for the office or for exercise, and some of the ones who were dressed for the gym were carrying babies or shepherding toddlers. So there was definitely a social realism about the pictures. A young teacher, a blonde New Zealander, Miss Davies, watched us all with a kindly smile.
"Do you like it?" Scout said, disturbed by my silence.
"I love it," I said. The truth was, it tore at my heart. The surrounding whiteness in Scout's picture seemed to overwhelm the three little figures, and I felt it again, as I knew I would feel it forever. The completeness of other families and the shattered nature of what was left of ours. I placed my hand on Scout's shoulder and she looked up at me with her mother's eyes. "Good work, Scout," I said.
"Miss Davies said just family," she said, and suddenly losing interest, wandered off to her desk to prepare for the first lesson.
It was time to go. Mothers and fathers were kissing their children goodbye and exchanging a few smiley words with the teacher, but I stood there until the bell went, looking up at Scout's picture of our family,
surrounded by all that empty white space.
Stan didn't like being left at home. He had upended his water dish, torn the puppy pad in his cage to shreds, and for an encore, climbed onto the coffee table and contemptuously battered away the mouse of my laptop, so it dangled just above the floorboards like a hanging man.
We stared at each other. A Cavalier would not have been my first choice for a dog, or even my fifth or sixth choice. I would have gone for something larger, a Labrador, a Golden Retriever, a German Shepherd. Stan considered me with his bulging eyes, absent-mindedly gnawing on a TV cable as I cleaned up his mess. Something larger and smarter, I thought. But Scout had done her research, and she knew what she wanted. Stan was her dog. And even if he burned the place down, I couldn't be angry with him today. Without Stan in our lives, all the white space around us might have swallowed us alive.
It was still early as Stan and I cut through Charterhouse Square on our way home from our walk. Mallory would be alone, up in MIR1, drinking his tea and figuring. Stan and I still had some time together before I put him in the custody of Mrs. Murphy and went to work. He was squatting for his wet when I became aware of the men on the bench, three of them, still up from last night. We got a lot of committed drinkers round our way, drawn by the all-night pubs surrounding Smithfield Meat Market. Two pasty-faced white boys in cheap grey sports gear and an Asian man, older and larger, wearing a T-shirt despite the early morning chill. A weightlifter. He was the one who made a kissing noise at my dog. I smiled. The three men stared back. It wasn't a good moment. Then Stan was scampering happily towards them, mad with excitement, pulling me, incredulous at the coincidence that they happened to be here at exactly the same time as him. I dropped the lead to allow him to greet them, and that was my mistake. The weightlifter picked Stan up, and picked him up all wrong, with both hands wrapped around the dog's chest, not supporting his weight with one hand under his butt, and recoiled with disgust when Stan attempted to lick his face. As his milky-faced mates laughed, the weightlifter dropped Stan heavily. He twisted as he fell, landing hard and yelping. Stan was whimpering now, his tail rigid between his legs, ears flattened, all the hallmarks of dog terror. He came back to me and I picked him up, one hand around his chest and the other under his bottom, the way you should hold a dog, and I held him to me, feeling the frantic drumbeat of his heart, because now he had learned fear.
"That's not a dog," the weightlifter said. "That's a rat."
"Man, you freaked it out because you wouldn't give it a kiss," said one of his mates.
"It's a dog," the other said, "but it's a gay dog."
They all laughed. I put Stan down, and he prostrated himself on the ground, his tail tucked up, his ears flattened, big eyes bulging. I placed a reassuring hand on his flank, feeling the fragile ribs under the silky chestnut fur, the small heart still pounding wildly. I held the lead loosely in my hand. The three men were still laughing on the bench. Tough guys, I thought. Tough guys who are only having a laugh. I tried to walk away as they chuckled and chatted among themselves, but Stan stopped for a sniff of a bin. Then he squatted on his hind legs, looking shyly at me as he emptied his bowels. I scooped the three little droppings up in a bag, tied a knot and placed the bag in the bin. They turned their attention back to my dog, pointing and leering. They had decided that Stan was here for their amusement. And that was their big mistake.
"Walk on," I said.
Stan's melancholy eyes rolled up to look at me. He made no attempt to move. The men roared.
"Walk on," the weightlifter said. "Do you hear him? Walk on," he says. "Hey, mate, does he bite? Or does he just suck your cock?"
I was looking down at Stan. He had never taken his eyes off me, and he seemed to flatten himself even lower now, his tail stiff and quivering between his legs, the paws either side of his head, the giant ears hanging down like shoulder-length hair, his chin pressed against the concrete. It had to happen one day. He had to learn fear sooner or later. We all have to learn fear. But it seemed a crying shame that it was today when I felt so grateful to him, genuinely grateful for joining me and Scout in our family portrait on her classroom wall. "Walk on," I said.
Still, Stan did not move.
Not very obedient, is he, man? The weightlifter said.
There was a confusion of cities in his accent, London and Los Angeles and Islamabad, and the very worst of all of those places. I wrapped the old leather dog lead around an empty bench in a loose knot and turned to the men. I wasn't talking to the dog, I said, walking towards them. The weightlifter stood up, his smile fading, and he opened his mouth to say something just as I punched him in the heart. One punch, right hand, full force. They don't do it in the movies, but the heart is the very worst place to be hit hard. You really don't want to get hit in the heart. It was a punch that began in the pivoting sole of my left boot and travelled up the muscles in my left leg, gaining full momentum with my twisting torso and then racing down my right arm into the first two knuckles on my right fist. Less than a second after it had begun its journey, the punch slammed with enormous force against the man's sternum, right on the flat bone at the front of the chest, where the upper ribs are attached by cartilage just in front of the heart. I can never understand why nobody ever punches the heart. Drunks in a bar fight would not think of punching their opponent's heart. Street fighters at closing time would never dream of hitting a man in his heart. The average job, like these three very average jobs in Charterhouse Square, know nothing about a blow to the heart, but I knew. The heart is everything. The weightlifter staggered backwards, his hands on his heart, reeling from the trauma of chest compression. He sat back down on the bench between his dumb friends, the fight all out of him. The punch had collapsed his sternum maybe an inch, no more, but it was devastating enough to shock the heart. I looked at the other two, their faces already frozen. They didn't know what to do now. I didn't expect them to. And I looked at the weightlifter, clutching his chest, pawing at his collapsed sternum, and I could see that he lacked the will to get back up. It was more than just the shock of being punched in the heart. The punch had induced tachycardia, an abrupt and terrifying increase in the heart rate. He felt like his heart was about to explode. He felt like he was dying. I walked back to my dog and rubbed his neck. This is Stan, I told them. Stan is a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. Cavs are the most peace-loving dogs in the world. They are famous for being mild-mannered and polite, great with children. They were the favourite dog of the Tudor and Stuart kings because of their gentle nature. The gentle nature that you can still see with Stan. We don't want any trouble, man, one of them said. I looked at him sharply. Can you see Stan's gentle nature or not? Yes, he said. I needed coffee immediately. A triple espresso that you could stand your spoon up in. Stan gazed at me with bashful love. He would sit on my lap outside the cafe and I would drink the short black coffee while I fed him nature's menu chicken treats until it was time to go to work. I nodded at the men, glad that they understood at last. He's not the one who bites, I said. Let's visit the dead, Mallory said at the morning briefing. If you cut across St. James's Park, it is a brisk 10-minute walk from 27 Savile Row to the Westminster Public Mortuary on Horseferry Road and the Ian West Forensic Suite. Ian West was the Elvis of forensic pathologists, Mallory told me, as Gain, Whitestone and I struggled to keep pace with him. A genius who changed everything. Proved WPC Yvonne Fletcher was shot from the Libyan embassy, located exactly where the Brighton bomb was placed in the Grand Hotel by interpreting the injuries of the victims. Examined the victims of the IRA atrocities at Harrods and Hyde Park, single-handedly improved rail safety with his autopsies of the King's Cross fire, and taught us all an invaluable lesson before dying while he was still a young man. What's that, sir? The dead can't lie. Deep inside the Ian West forensic suite, we waited patiently in our blue scrubs and hairnets as Elsa Olsen, forensic pathologist, smiled and spoke with all the polite good grace of a hostess of a dinner party who was about to make the introductions. Elsa had a lovely smile, I thought, as she turned her friendly gaze from our faces to the two naked corpses on the stainless steel tables before us.
"Our mystery man,"
she said, indicating the drug-withered body of the homeless man.
"Adam Jones, born New Year's Day 1973, died 10th of October 2008.
She indicated his neighbour, the overfed body of the banker.
"And Hugo Buck, who I think you know already, born on the 7th of January 1973, died 9th of October 2008.
Elsa let the dates sink in. Mallory and I stared hard at the bodies, born within 7 days of each other and died within 24 hours of each other. But what else connected them, apart from the livid wounds that had opened up their throats, now gaping black slits? They looked as though they were from different planets. Even in death, Hugo Buck's body looked like that of a good amateur sportsman who was only just starting to run to expense account fat. It was the body of a man who had serious gym sessions a few times a week, probably a personal trainer screaming at him for 50 quid an hour, no matter how busy he got at work. But the years were passing, and there were plenty of meals at good restaurants during a working day, and a steady social drinking habit. You wife-beating bastard. In comparison, the shell of Adam Jones looked totally depleted. A pathetic sack of bones blotted with bad tattoos and veins scarred by damaged tissue. The squalid souvenirs of 1,000 needles. He already looked on the cusp of old age, as if he had shot not just opiates into his vein, but all his future years. I shuddered. The temperature was kept just above zero in here. Beyond an impatience to get started, I felt nothing when I looked at the bodies. Their spirits had flown. Now they were just the living in this freezing room, and two brutalized, empty husks.
"The four questions of death," Elsa Olsen continued. "Cause, mechanism, manner, time."
She smiled pleasantly.
"Death's fifth and final question, who, I leave to you, gentlemen."
A smile for D.I. Whitestone.
"And lady."
Elsa stepped between the two steel tables.
"Cause of death for both men was suffocation," she said.
Mallory said, "They didn't bleed to death."
Elsa shook her head. "The single wound to the neck caused a massive hemorrhage. Death would have been quick, quiet, and messy. An initial spray, perhaps several, as the artery was cut, and then massive bleeding. As you noted, DCI Mallory, the trachea was severed, so screaming was a physical impossibility. There was nothing left to scream with. But it wasn't just the trachea that was cut. The carotid artery was also severed along with the internal jugular vein. Death would have been almost immediate. But neither man had the chance to bleed to death. They suffocated before they had the chance to bleed out." Elsa spoke the effortlessly perfect English of the Scandinavian abroad. She was 40-ish, Norwegian, tall and slim and dark. One of those black-haired, blue-eyed Norwegians who defied the Nordic stereotype. Mallory had told me that she was his favourite pathologist because she talked about the dead as if they had once been among the living. He said they did not all do that. "We don't have a weapon," Mallory said. "We don't even have an idea of a weapon."
"What kind of blade can cut a throat like that, Elsa?"
"The mechanism would need to be long and thin and razor sharp," Elsa answered. She peered at the gaping black letterbox in Hugo Buck's neck, which extended from ear to ear. "The assailant was standing behind the victim, as we can see from the classic long sweep of the wound. The mechanism would be something like a short double-edged sword, a long scalpel, something similar, something with a sharp stabbing point and good cutting edges. These are remarkably clean cuts. A torn artery tends to contract and stem the bleeding, but a cleanly cut artery starts bleeding and it doesn't stop."
And then, almost as an afterthought, she said,
"Manner of death was murder."
"Time of death,"
Whitestone said.
"Hugo Buck had an algor mortis, or temperature of death,
of 97 degrees Fahrenheit, Elsa said, not far below normal body temperature of 98.6. Adam Jones was 95 degrees, but Mr. Jones died on the street and Mr. Buck died in a climate-controlled office. And bodies lose temperature more quickly in the open air, Whitestone said, looking at Gain. Adam Jones was found just after 7 p.m., Elsa said. I would estimate the time of death was between 5 and 7 p.m. Hugo Buck was found at 6 a.m., and I would estimate time of death between 4 a.m. and 6. Mallory smiled. 2-hour windows, Elsa. Not taking many chances, are you? He looked at his detectives. I think we just missed them. Both of them. I think they both died just before we got there. The pathologist raised her hands, the perfect hostess trying to avoid an unpleasant scene. Time of death is only ever a best guess, she said. You know that as well as I do.
We have to cut Elsa some slack, Mallory said, still smiling. Time of death can eliminate subjects or damn them. So time of death is where our forensic colleagues are at their most cagey and least willing to speculate.
And where the investigating detectives are most desperate for accuracy, Elsa added.
Defensive wounds, Gain said. I can't see anything obvious.
Nothing, the pathologist said. Neither of them had the will or the chance to put up a fight. There are no defensive wounds on the hands, arms, wrists, legs, or feet. She peered at the body of Adam Jones. Although on the body of Mr. Jones, I did discover some old cuts, bruises, and abrasions from minor, earlier incidents.
Life on the streets, I said, takes its toll. No sign of recent substance abuse. He wasn't using at the time of death.
Elsa shook her head. Surprisingly not. There was a note of pity in her voice. Mr. Jones was drug-free. He was trying to change his ways, despite what you can see.
What we could see were the exhausted veins on the man's arms, track marks, the miniature railway lines of heroin abuse. They were fading now.
I think he was trying to kick the habit, Elsa continued. I think he had tried more than once. She smiled apologetically. Do stop me if I start doing your job.
Mallory said, Star sign?
Elsa stared at him. Taurus, she said. The oboe you mention in your notes gave it away. Taurians are lovers of music and song. Then she smiled. Oh, bugger off, Mallory.
We all laughed.
I leaned close to the dead men, looking at the neck of first Adam Jones and then Hugo Buck. In length, depth, and darkness, the wounds were absolutely identical.
One cut, I said, shaking my head. Just one cut in the right place.
Sometimes one cut is all it takes, Mallory said. The assassination squad stabbed Julius Caesar 23 times, but the Roman physician who examined him concluded that Caesar would have survived the assault if not for the wound to his heart.
Elsa pointed at the wounds where she had cut open, examined, and then closed up their stomachs. As you noted from his locked fists, Mr. Buck had a cadaveric spasm in the moment of his death. Instant rigor, she said. What you like to call that Pompeii moment, Mallory. But Mr. Jones is different. There was rigor in his legs, but only in the legs. As you know, rigor mortis usually takes 2 hours to kick in unless there's a cadaveric spasm, as in the case of Mr. Buck, or a loss of energy in a part of the body that causes a chemical reaction, a loss of adenosine triphosphate, ATP, that makes the muscles stiffen and contract. So rigor in the legs means one thing. There was strenuous muscle activity in the legs prior to death.
We considered the corpse of Adam Jones.
So Jones was running, Mallory said.
He was being chased, I said.
Elsa Olsen smiled at me, like a teacher looking at her star student. She held out her hand as if I had won a prize. And this belonged to Mr. Buck, she said, and dropped something into my palm. A small blue thing
round and hard and staring at me from beyond the grave. Hugo Buck had a glass eye, she announced. Chapter 6. It was late afternoon, with the day's light already fading, when I parked outside the block of flats in Regent's Park. The trees in the park were at their most beautiful now, a riot of red and gold leaves that had not yet become serious about falling. But it wouldn't be long, I thought as I walked to the glass doors, wishing I had a coat. You could feel the world turning. The porter let me in. Natasha Buck opened her door in her robe again. I couldn't decide if it was a bit early to be in a robe or very late. But this time her hair wasn't wet, and this time she wasn't alone. A man moved across the living room, glaring at me, with a frosted champagne flute in one hand and a cigarette in the other. I recognised the chauffeur, who had been lounging in the big black Merc. I recognised him even in his underpants. It must have been all my training.
"You're too late," Mrs. Buck said.
"This will only take a minute," I said. The chauffeur came to the door, sipping his drink. He had come up in the world.
"Is there a problem?" he said.
"Not yet," I said. "Would you like one?"
"I'll be in the other room," he said.
Smart chauffeur. He went away and took his iced champagne flute with him. "Tell me about your husband's eye," I said, "the one he lost."
"What do you want to know?"
"How it happened."
"At school," she said, "at Potter's Field. He told me he was kicked in the eye when scoring a try. Hugo was a natural athlete." She sounded proud of him. "All those sports the English invented, rugby, cricket, tennis, football, they came easy to him."
"So it's something that happened when he was a boy?"
Natasha Buck nodded. "He was very good at games."
The next morning I left West End Central after our morning briefing, and 1 hour later I was parking the X5 on a sweeping gravel drive and looking up at a large detached house. It felt like the countryside. Adam Jones had fallen a long way, I thought, as a Filipina housekeeper let me in. She left me in the hall, and I stared through glass doors at the back garden while I waited for the dead man's mother. There was a neglected swimming pool out there, the surface coated with dead leaves, and the huge garden was wild and overgrown. A fox dozed undisturbed on the far side of the pool, as if he knew that no gardener was coming round any time soon. The house felt abandoned, but there had been money here once. Maybe the money was still here. Maybe it wasn't the money that had run out. There was one painting on the wall, a shaft of dying sunlight striking the side of a skyscraper. It was a city street, but the people had all gone home. It was clearly by the same artist as the one on the wall in Hugo Buck's apartment, and there in the corner I found the same two lowercase initials, J.S.
"Thank you so much for coming," Mrs. Jones said, coming down the stairs with her hands outstretched as if paying a social call.
I tried not to look shocked, but I recognised the function of the colourful scarf she had tied around her head and the pale, puffy look that comes with long months of intensive chemotherapy. This lady was dying. And yet there was an undeniable, youthful beauty about her appearance. Under the headscarf, beyond the cancer and the chemo, there was an unlined face, preserved in time like some enchanted creature from a magic land. "Mrs. Jones," I said, "I'm D.C. Wolfe," and we spoke briefly on the phone. I offered my warrant card, and she smiled at it politely. "Mrs. Jones, I'm so sorry for the loss of your son." She flexed her mouth with a spasm of pain, nodded once and composed herself. She was a proud woman and determined not to show her heart to a man she would probably never see again.
"Please," she said,
gesturing towards the living room. I followed her. She moved with the careful deliberation of someone whose body has betrayed them. I waited until she had sunk into an armchair and then took my place on the sofa opposite. An ancient black Labrador padded silently into the room, sniffed the hand that I offered, and then ambled over to settle on its owner's feet. The Filipina housekeeper appeared.
"Tea, please, Rosalita," said Mrs. Jones.
Then she looked at me, with her shining eyes, bright blue behind her spectacles, intelligent eyes that were still shocked with grief.
"I do appreciate you coming," she said. "And how are your inquiries progressing? Have you arrested anyone yet?"
"No, ma'am," I said. "But if you could answer some questions, that would be an enormous help to our investigation."
She nodded,
her hand absent-mindedly stroking the back of the black lab's neck. The dog grunted with contentment. "Your son," I said, "Adam. It would be helpful if you could tell me about Adam." I hesitated. "He had no fixed abode at the time of his death." His mother smiled, remembering an earlier time.
"He was a very gifted boy," she said. "Enormously talented, sensitive, a wonderful musician, wonderful."
She looked around the room, and now I saw that it was a shrine to her dead son. On the bookshelves were trophies, prizes, and small white busts of men having bad hair days, Beethoven and the boys. Between the shelves, the walls were covered with framed certificates, and massed on top of a small piano was an array of silver-framed photographs.
"My son was at the Royal Academy of Music," Mrs. Jones told me, "for one term, before they asked him to leave."
Rosalita brought our tea. Mrs. Jones lifted a hand, and the housekeeper understood that we would serve ourselves. I waited until she had left the room. "Why did they ask Adam to leave?" Mrs. Jones ruffled the dog between the ears, her face clenched with tension, and I saw that she was in what must have been constant pain.
"Because," she said, "there was a darkness in him."
She smiled with an old sadness.
"I don't know how else to explain it. There was a darkness in my son, and that led him to the drugs, and then the drugs took away everything."
"I think he was trying to stop," I said. "The autopsy showed there were no drugs in Adam's body at the time of his death."
"Yes, he was trying to stop. He was trying very hard."
She looked at me.
"Thank you," she said.
I wasn't sure what she was thanking me for, and I didn't know how to respond. Mrs. Jones poured our tea. I looked out of the windows. The fox had gone. "When was the last time you saw your son?"
"A month ago. He came to borrow some money."
She laughed. "Borrow. That's a good one.
His father died 2 years ago, and it was easier for my son to come home and ask for money, to borrow money after that. When his father was alive, it was difficult. Arguments, refusals, raised voices, tearful promises to change his ways, that you can imagine. And things disappeared. A watch left by a bedside, money in a wallet. That made relations with his father very difficult. But he never stole from me, not from me. And some do, I know. Some heroin addicts, and my son was certainly a heroin addict, do steal from the people who love them most."
I sipped my tea. Already Adam Jones had become more than a homeless junkie found dead in an alley, more than a naked corpse on a freezing bed of stainless steel. He had become somebody's son.
"And I saw him last night," Mrs. Jones said, "my son, Adam, in my dreams or in my sleep, but it didn't feel like a dream. He was very sad. Have you ever heard of such a thing?" She laughed again. The dog sat up and then settled. "Am I going dotty in my old age?"
"I think it happens all the time," I said. "A loved one appearing in a dream. Especially at the start. Especially when you've just lost them. I think it takes a while before the dead rest easy."
She looked at me. "I get so tired," she said.
She gestured impatiently at her headscarf.
"All this business."
I nodded. "Perhaps you're not eating as you should, Mrs. Jones," I said. I hesitated for a moment. "Chemotherapy makes food taste awful."
"Yes, it does," she said. "They tell you about the hair loss and the nausea. Everyone knows about that, but they don't warn you about what it does to your sense of taste." She looked at me levelly. "You seem to know something about the subject."
Not really. My grandmother went through the same thing, but it was a long time ago."
"You must have been close to your grandmother."
"She brought me up," I said.
She raised me after my parents died. She was more like my mother.
I see. Your grandmother sounds like a wonderful woman.
She was the kindest person I've ever met, I said.
And then she died?
Yes. Please tell me some more about Adam. Did he have enemies? She raised her eyebrows.
Somebody killed him.
Somebody did that to him. But he was a gentle boy. Everyone loved him. Everyone who ever met him, as far as I know. Mrs. Jones, most murder victims know their killer. Can you think of anyone who would want to harm Adam? When he came home, did he talk about his money problems, money that he owed, outstanding debts?
Money problems were a way of life for my son, she replied. But there was no malice in him. He was one of those people who make the world a better place. Then he lost his way and he never found his way back. And it didn't do any good, however much we loved him, however much it hurt us, however much we wanted him to be well, however much he wanted it for himself, none of it mattered. But under it all, he was a good boy, a happy boy. And there wasn't always that sadness in him. There wasn't always that darkness.
She suddenly seemed very tired. She nodded towards the piano and the silver-framed photographs.
Look for yourself. Look at my son. Go on.
It was more than an invitation.
Look,
she said. I went across to the piano, where there were dozens of photographs. But they were all of a baby and a boy. It was as if Adam Jones had never made it beyond his middle teens. There were shots of a bonny baby in his cot and in the arms of Mrs. Jones when she was young and pretty and healthy, in love with life and her newborn son, laughing with delight at the miracle of this baby. And then Adam as a chubby-legged toddler, holding hands with his father, both of them smiling on some sunny English beach. And Adam a bit older, 6 or 7, long-haired and grinning to reveal the gaps in his front teeth, holding a child's violin. The boy grew before my eyes, but he did not grow to manhood, not in these photographs. I looked across at Mrs. Jones. Her eyes were closed. The dog had seized the opportunity to climb onto the sofa and snuggle up to her. Her head was drooping forward.
I get so very tired, she said, looking up at me sharply. Did your grandmother experience that tiredness?
Yes, ma'am. I picked up a photograph of Adam at the age of about 10. On stage in an evening suit standing before an audience of adults and children who were on their feet and clapping. He held a child-sized oboe in his hands. I put it back down. Chemotherapy makes you exhausted, I said. I looked at her and she was sleeping. I turned back to the piano, my eyes ranging over the photographs, waiting for them to tell me something. No brothers, no sisters. Adam as a little boy in his Superman pajamas, a posed picture of a youth orchestra, and another a year or two later, and sitting in front of his mother on a carousel, both of them grinning and waving as their horse rode past the camera. Goodbye, Daddy, goodbye. I was holding the photograph in my hands before I knew it. The silver frame was flecked with the first signs of age. And I held it for a long moment before I realized that the Filipina housekeeper, Rosalita, was standing in the doorway watching me. She came into the room and began to clear away the tea things. I looked back at the photograph in my hands. Soldiers, I saw. Young men in uniform, I saw. This was the same photograph I had seen in the Shining Tower, sitting all alone on the desk of Hugo Buck, splashed with his fresh blood. The same 7, with the same unbreakable smiles. And again I saw that it was only at first glance that it looked like a photograph of soldiers. Despite the old-fashioned military uniforms, these were boys, not men. Schoolboys dressed as warriors. No, not men, but boys who would not be boys for much longer. One of them was the young, unspoilt Adam Jones. And the other, on the far side of the photograph, was the teenage Hugo Buck. I had only known them a couple of decades later, as dead men, murder victims, drowned in their own blood. I had only ever seen them as corpses on stainless steel slabs in the cold room of the Ian West forensic suite. But when you looked, when you really looked, they were both unmistakable.
I must have nodded off, Mrs. Jones said, suddenly standing next to me and so close and so unexpected that I almost gasped out loud. She took the frame from me, looked at the photograph as if she had not seen it for a while, then replaced it exactly where it had been, in its little groove of dust on the black lacquer of the piano. She'd wanted me to see, and she'd wanted me to understand, but I saw now that this courteous, kind and dying woman would really prefer it if I did not actually touch her photographs. Did you ever meet Hugo Buck, Mrs. Jones?
Hugo? I haven't seen him for what must be nearly 20 years. He went into the city. I understand he's doing very well.
And your son knew Hugo Buck, I said. They were friends, weren't they? She nodded.
At Potter's Field. They were at school together.
Chapter 7. I drove back to 27 Savile Row, and for the rest of that day and for most of the next, our team never left Major Incident Room 1. The discovery of the second photograph changed everything. It gave us our MLOE, main line of inquiry, and focused all of the double homicide investigation on 7 schoolboys in military uniform grinning at a camera 20 years ago. Work out from the photograph, applying the ABC principle at all times, DCI Mallory warned us, moving between the workstations where we hunted, our phones on permanent charge, and Homes 2, the Home Office Large Major Inquiry System, the mainframe police computer, flickering on the screens in front of us. Assume nothing, believe nothing, challenge and check everything. The sky was flat and white above the rooftops of Mayfair when Mallory faced us for his afternoon briefing. He ran a hand across his scalp and took a joyless gulp of cold takeaway tea. Right, he said. What are we looking at? We were looking at the large flat plasma screen on the wall of MIR1, and on the screen was the photograph that had been in the home of Adam Jones's mother and also on Hugo Buck's desk. D.I. Whitestone, the MIT's deputy SIO, cleared her throat and said, Sir, this photograph was taken at Potter's Field College in the spring of 1988. Potter's Field College is a boarding school for boys aged 13 to 18 on the border of Berkshire and Buckinghamshire. The 7 boys in the photograph are all wearing the uniform of the school's combined cadet force. On the far left of the picture is Adam Jones, and on the far right is Hugo Buck. Next to the screen was Mallory's wall, a massive whiteboard with a physical photograph of the 7 smiling boys, 8 inches by 10 inches out of its frame, looking tiny tacked up there, and next to it a selection of pictures of Jones and Buck, taken at the scenes of their murder and again at their autopsy at the Ian West. The Combined Cadet Force is the Potter's Field version of the Officer Training Corps, Whitestone continued, which they still go in for at a lot of these old public schools. And Potter's Field is one of the oldest, Mallory said. 500 years old? It has to be as old as Harrow, St. Paul's, Westminster, Winchester, Rugby and Marlborough. And, of course, Slough Comprehensive. He glanced at our blank faces. Eton, he explained. They call themselves Slough Comprehensive. It's their little joke. What's our source for the photograph? I said, Sir, this is the copy I obtained from the mother of Adam Jones. And we're absolutely certain it's the same one that was on the desk of Hugo Buck. D.I. Gain looked up from his laptop. The one at the bank had some superficial damage, sir. There was a blood trace that had seeped under the glass, but it's the same photograph, all right. And were Jones and Buck in contact after leaving school? Mallory asked. Looks like they went their separate ways, sir, I replied. Jones's mother hadn't seen Hugo Buck in nearly 20 years. She wasn't aware of his death. Gain said, Doesn't she read the papers? She's in the last stage of terminal cancer, I said. I think she has other things on her mind. Because the mother wasn't aware of contact doesn't mean there wasn't any, Gain reasoned.
Natasha Buck, Hugo Buck's widow, has no recollection of ever meeting Adam Jones, I said. She would have remembered a homeless heroin addict turning up at their door or their wedding.
Jones tried to make contact with Buck at his office, Whitestone said. I spoke to the PA at China Corps, and she can remember a man claiming to be an old friend of Buck's turning up at the office wanting to see him. This is 2 or 3 years back. She described the man as looking like a tramp. Sounds like Jones. But Buck wouldn't see him, and security had to escort the unknown visitor from the building. Apparently, it was an ugly little scene.
The junkie tapping his rich mate for money and getting a knockback, Gaines said.
That's a reasonable assumption, Mallory said.
So we're definitely treating this as a double homicide, sir? Gaines asked. We're working on the theory that it's the same perp, even without contact since, what's the school, Potter's Field?
Yes, Mallory confirmed. The killer's M.O., the manner of death, the school connection, it's enough. It's more than enough. How are we doing with prints?
We've identified and eliminated all the prints found in the China Corps office, Gaines said. The alley where Jones was found is a forensic nightmare full of prints that we can't identify and never will.
Glove prints? Mallory said.
No, boss. Sorry, boss.
Mallory shook his bald head. There should be glove prints.
He stared up at the photograph.
Who are the other 5 boys?
We're chasing that down, sir, Whitestone said. Should have names by the end of play today. DC Wolfe's going to talk to Adam Jones's mother again, and I've sanded out the school. The headmaster's calling me.
And I want the photographer, please, Mallory said. Find out who took the photograph, will you, D.I. Whitestone? And give us a close-up, would you, D.I. Gain?
Gain tapped some keys, and the camera seemed to move in for a better look. 7 faces swam out of the past and into vivid close-up. We looked at them in silence. The boys had all looked the same to me at first, 7 smiling sons of privilege, cocky and smug in their military uniforms and their mullet haircuts, certain that tomorrow belonged to them. But now they were starting to look like individuals. Adam Jones on the left, a skinny kid with an open, guileless face, looking far younger than the rest. The only one who still looked like a child. Hugo Buck on the right, dark and mannish, already looking like he needed to shave every day, confident in his looks and his strength and his place in the world. I was looking harder at the photo, really seeing it for the first time. They were not all the same. They were not even all smiling. In the middle of the group was a serious, delicate-looking boy in dark glasses. His fringe swept back off a high forehead. He was flanked by the twins, identical, I could now see, tall, good-looking, and cold. One of them had a jumble of jagged scars running down one side of his face. Next to the twin with the scars, between him and Adam Jones, there was a chubby, leering adolescent, the tip of his tongue exploring a corner of his mouth. And on the other side, next to Buck, there was a grinning, dark-skinned youth, possibly Indian, far taller than the rest. Only their uniforms were the same.
So what exactly is this combined cadet force? Gaines said. Posh, rich kids playing soldiers?
They take it seriously, Mallory said. A significant number of boys take up commissions in these schools. I bet the British Army is still the biggest employer of old Potter's Field boys. Even now, they say that old Etonians go into the army, politics, and acting, while old Potters go into the army, bunking, and jail.
I wondered how Mallory knew so much about it.
But what's the point of them, Gaines persisted. The officer training corps, the combined cadet force. Why do a bunch of public schoolboys need to dress up as soldiers?